Joseph taught and encouraged his adherents to receive personal communiques straight from the Lord. Divine revelation formed the bedrock of the religion. God, of course, regularly communicated with Joseph as well as his followers. The imparting of heavenly truth began with the Book of Mormon, but by no means did it end there. The Lord routinely issued commandments to Joseph, continually revealing sacred principles that needed to be revised or changed outright. Indeed, the notion that each Mormon prophet receives guidance from an ongoing series of revelations was, and remains, one of the religion's crucial tenets. These revelations are compiled in a thin volume titled The Doctrine and Covenants, which in some ways has supplanted the Book of Mormon as the Latter-day Saints' most consequential scriptural text. With these revealed scriptures guiding the way, Joseph made his divine mission known. His job was to reinstate the Lord's one true church and thereby prepare the earth for the second coming of Christ, which was surely imminent. Joseph explained to his rapt followers that they were the Lord's elect, God's own peculiar people, the true sons and daughters of Israel, and every one of them would be called on to play a crucial role in the last days before the millennium drew nigh. They were, Joseph declared, Latter-day Saints. Chapter 7. The Still Small Voice. From its inception, the revelatory tradition in Mormonism engendered strife. The doctrine of modern, continuing revelation, begun by Joseph Smith and accepted by most groups claiming dissent, leaves social order open to counterclaims that strike at the heart of ecclesiastical order. If one person may speak for God, why may not another? By claiming an ongoing dialogue with divinity, Joseph Smith opened the door to a social force he could barely control. Richard L. Saunders, The Fruit of the Branch, Differing Visions, Dissenters in Mormon History. Yea, thus saith the still small voice, which whispereth through and pierceth all things, and oftentimes it maketh my bones to quake while it maketh manifest, saying, And it shall come to pass that I, the Lord God, will send one mighty and strong to set in order the house of God. The Doctrine and Covenants, Section 85. The brick farmhouse stands by itself, surrounded by snow-covered fields in a sparsely populated Utah valley. Mist rises off a nearby river in the 8-degree cold. Inside, a tall, blue-eyed man sits at an uncluttered desk, studying a book through wire-rimmed spectacles. As he bends closer to the page to wrest meaning from the lines of type, winter sunlight streams through a nearby window and glints off the top of his shiny pate, which is ringed with a halo of wispy white hair. The man's name is Robert Crossfield, and the volume that so intensely commands his attention is titled The Second Book of Commandments. He wrote and published it himself under the other name he is known by, the Prophet Onias. Modeled after the Doctrine and Covenants, the collected revelations of Joseph Smith, the Second Book of Commandments is a compilation of 205 revelations Crossfield/Onias has received from the Lord since 1961. Crossfield is a Mormon fundamentalist and a polygamist, but he insists that his belief system amounts to a much kinder, more compassionate brand of faith than the fundamentalism of Rulon Jeffs, Winston Blackmore, or Dan Lafferty, three men with whom he is intimately acquainted. Notably, for instance, Crossfield detests violence, and although he is convinced of the divine righteousness of plural marriage as the principle was revealed to Joseph Smith, he believes it is sinful for a man to coerce a woman to marry him, or even to ask a woman to marry him. In every case, the woman must choose the man for the marriage to be legitimate. Born in northern Alberta in 1929, Crossfield is the son of a farmer who went broke trying to homestead on the prairie west of Edmonton. As a 19-year-old, Robert came down with tuberculosis and was confined to a sanatorium for 9 months. While bedridden, he passed the endless hours by reading whatever the nurses brought around, and one of the books left by his bedside happened to be a copy of the Book of Mormon. The young Robert Crossfield, who was not religious, was moved by boredom to open the book and read it. In the back of the Book of Mormon, says Crossfield, it promises that if you read it with a sincere heart and you ask the Lord if it's true, he'll manifest the truth of it unto you by the gift of the Holy Ghost. Well, the Holy Ghost came to me after I finished it and showed me very strongly that this book was true. So I converted myself to the Mormon Church. Crossfield became an active and very pious saint, was married in the Edmonton LDS Temple, and went to work as an accountant to support his growing family. Then in March 1961, while he was toiling over a ledger at McLeod Mercantile in Spruce Grove, Alberta, the still small voice of the Lord suddenly came to him, revealing that he had been chosen to serve as God's mouthpiece, that he was a holy prophet of the Lord. And the very first words God uttered to him that day affirmed the correctness of D&C 132 and the principle of plural marriage. A few months after God first spoke to him, Crossfield left Spruce Grove to become office manager of a farmers' cooperative in Creston, British Columbia, a small agricultural town immediately north of the Idaho Panhandle. Just down the road from Creston, it turned out, was a flock of fundamentalists allied with the UEP polygamists, who lived in what was then called Short Creek, Arizona. Like their brethren in the States at that time, the Creston polygamists followed the teachings of Prophet Leroy Johnson, the humble, much-beloved Uncle Roy. Upon his arrival in Creston, Crossfield heard about the polygs in the neighborhood and was curious. He began attending their prayer meetings. Right away, they struck him as kindred souls. Debbie Palmer was 6 years old when Crossfield appeared in Bountiful. She remembers him as a dour, wraith-like man with a pockmarked face who would show up at her home to have long theological discussions with her father. Crossfield was a mysterious presence, she recalls, who hovered at the fringe of the community. When I was a young girl, the prophet Onias, I guess he was still calling himself Robert Crossfield in those days, seemed weird and creepy. My friends and I were terrified we would be forced to marry him as soon as we turned 14. Crossfield made a much better impression on Ray Blackmore, Uncle Roy, Debbie's dad, and the other fundamentalist leaders, who admired his forthrightness and integrity and soon invited him to join their community. God continued to speak to Crossfield throughout his tenure in the Creston Valley, as he immersed himself in fundamentalist doctrine. Most of these revelations closely reiterated the teachings of Uncle Roy, confirming that the leaders of the LDS Church had cut themselves off from the voice of the Lord and betrayed some of Joseph Smith's most important tenets, including the sacred principle of plural marriage. By 1972, Crossfield had received 23 significant revelations, which he collected into a single volume titled The First Book of Commandments, paid a few thousand dollars to have printed and distributed to libraries and religious bookstores across Canada and the Western United States. But one of these slender tomes happened to find its way into the hands of LDS President Mark E. Peterson in Salt Lake City. And that was the end of my church membership, Crossfield explains. Came right from the top. I was excommunicated from the Mormon Church. A tight laugh erupts from deep within his chest. I loved that church. Still do, in fact. It brought me great joy to attend every Sunday, and I kept going to church long after I was excommunicated. But then they eventually told me I couldn't come anymore. Rejection by the mainline church was considered a badge of honor by the Creston fundamentalists, who admired Crossfield for his outspoken views, until God began revealing to Crossfield that Uncle Roy and the other UEP leaders had themselves gone astray and were misinterpreting various important points of sacred doctrine. Not to put too fine a point on it, in 1974, God told Crossfield that Crossfield's version of the one true church was correct, and Uncle Roy's version was wrong. Back in March 1962, just a few months after Crossfield began attending prayer meetings with the polygamists in Creston, God had told him, "I will raise up one mighty and strong among you, having the scepter of justice in his hand, who shall grind in pieces all those who would oppose my work, for the prayer of the righteous shall not go unheeded." This was a direct reference to D&C 85, in which God first told Joseph Smith that he would be sending one mighty and strong to set in order the house of God. Over the years, more than 20 fundamentalists, Ron Lafferty, Rulon Jeffs, and Brian David Mitchell, the abductor of Elizabeth Smart among them, have claimed to be the one mighty and strong sent by God to reinstate the doctrine of plural marriage and set in order the modern LDS Church. Although Crossfield never explicitly claimed in public to be the one mighty and strong, several of his published revelations leave little doubt that, privately at least, he believed he might indeed be the one. In a commandment Crossfield received in 1975, God called him by the name Onias, revealed that he was the true prophet and rightful leader of the LDS Church, and explained that Onias had been put on earth specifically to set in order my church. In the Old Testament, Onias was a Jewish high priest who lived in Jerusalem 2 centuries before Christ. Onias gained renown for defying the ruling tyrant, King Antiochus Epiphanes, and refusing to worship his idols. To punish Onias, the king stripped him of his priesthood and installed a toady, Menelaus, in his stead. Onias responded by gathering an army of 1,000 men, storming the temple in Jerusalem, and banishing Menelaus, enabling the Jews to worship within its sacred walls once again. Coincidentally, or perhaps not, Robert Crossfield had an ancestor named William Onias Crossfield, born in Quebec in 1879. According to God, Uncle Roy and his lieutenants in the UEP were supposed to take their marching orders from Crossfield / Onias. Of course, none of this went over well with Uncle Roy or the other men who ran the UEP's affairs in Creston and Colorado City. The leader of the Creston polygamists promptly informed Crossfield / Onias that his presence was no longer welcome at the Creston prayer meetings, and he was kicked out of the UEP. Unfazed, Onias moved to Idaho and then, in the early 1980s, to a little town outside of Provo, Utah. The official title of the supreme leader of the LDS Church, today as in centuries past, is President, Prophet, Seer, and Revelator. This is because from its inception, Mormonism was a faith in which religious truth and ecclesiastical authority were supposed to be derived from a never-ending string of divine revelations. In the beginning, Joseph Smith had emphasized the importance of personal revelation for everyone. Denigrating the established churches of the day, which were more inclined to filter the Word of God through institutional hierarchies, he instructed Mormons to seek direct impressions from the Lord, which should guide them in every aspect of their lives. Quickly, however, Joseph saw a major drawback to such a policy. If God spoke directly to all Mormons, who was to say that the truths he revealed to Joseph had greater validity than contradictory truths he might reveal to somebody else? With everyone receiving revelations, the prophet stood to lose control of his followers. Joseph acted fast to resolve this dilemma by announcing in 1830, the same year the Mormon Church was incorporated, that God had belatedly given him another revelation. No one shall be appointed to receive commandments and revelations in this church excepting my servant, Joseph Smith, Jr. But the genie was already out of the bottle. Joseph had taught and encouraged his saints to receive personal revelations, and the concept proved to be immensely popular. People liked talking to God directly, one-on-one, without intermediaries. It was one of the most appealing aspects of Joseph's new church. Thus, even after Joseph told his followers that henceforth they were forbidden to receive divine commandments concerning church doctrine, many of these saints quietly ignored the edict and continued to heed the voice of God, whether he was talking to them about matters of theology or personal issues. The simple fact was God's words were always going to carry more weight than Joseph's, and there wasn't much the prophet could do about it. This goes a long way toward explaining why, since 1830, some 200 schismatic Mormon sects have splintered off from Joseph's original religion. In fact, sects continue to splinter off on an ongoing basis. The UEP communities in Colorado City and Creston are a prime example. The followers of Robert Crossfield, the prophet Onias, are another. And one of them would turn out to be Dan Lafferty. An hour down the interstate from Salt Lake City, the stolid, can-do city of Provo covers the flats between Utah Lake and 11,000-foot Provo Peak. Boasting a population of slightly more than 100,000, it is the seat of Utah County and home to both the LDS Missionary Training Center, from which 30,000 young men and women go forth each year to proselytize around the globe, and Brigham Young University, BYU, Mormondom's flagship institution of higher learning, owned and tightly controlled by the LDS Church. For a person accustomed to the multi-ethnic commotion of Los Angeles, Vancouver, New York, or even Denver, walking across the BYU campus can be a jarring experience. One sees no graffiti, not a speck of litter. More than 99% of the 30,000 students are white. Each of the young Mormons one encounters is astonishingly well-groomed and neatly dressed. Beards, tattoos, and pierced ears, or other body parts, are strictly forbidden for men. Immodest attire and more than a single piercing per ear are forbidden among women. Smoking, using profane language, and drinking alcohol or even coffee are likewise banned. Heeding the dictum, "Cougars don't cut corners," students keep to the sidewalks as they hurry to make it to class on time. Nobody would think of attempting to shave a few precious seconds by treading on the manicured grass. Everyone is cheerful, friendly, and unfailingly polite. Most non-Mormons think of Salt Lake City as the geographic heart of Mormonism, but in fact half the population of Salt Lake is Gentile, and many Mormons regard that city as a sinful, iniquitous place that's been corrupted by outsiders. To the saints themselves, the true Mormon heartland is here in Provo and surrounding Utah County, the site of chaste little towns like Highland, American Fork, Orem, Payson, and Salem, where the population is nearly 90% LDS. The Sabbath is taken seriously in these parts. Almost all businesses close on Sunday, as do public swimming pools, even on the hottest days of the summer months. This part of the state is demographically notable in other aspects as well. The LDS Church forbids abortions, frowns on contraception, and teaches that Mormon couples have a sacred duty to give birth to as many children as they can support, which goes a long way toward explaining why Utah County has the highest birth rate in the United States. It is higher, in fact, than the birth rate in Bangladesh. This also happens to be the most Republican county and the most Republican state in the nation. Not coincidentally, Utah County is a stronghold not only of Mormonism, but also Mormon fundamentalism. Salem is a farming community 12 miles south of Provo, situated where the orchards and potato fields of the East Bench rub up against the high, craggy mountains of the Wasatch Front. This is where Dan Lafferty was born and raised. From miles away, one's eyes are drawn to a gargantuan white structure clinging to the steep hillside immediately above Salem. The legendary Dream Mine, which drew the prophet Onias to the area in the early 1980s. The Dream Mine was the life work of a salt-of-the-earth Mormon named John Hiram Coyle, who passed away in 1949 at the age of 84. Coyle counted himself among those special saints who had been blessed with the gift of prophecy. He'd predicted the stock market crash of 1929 to the exact day. He'd prophesied the date World War II would end. He'd foretold of the devastating floods that swept through northern Utah 34 years after his death. But his most notable and far-reaching prophecy concerned the Dream Mine. On the night of August 27, 1894, the angel Moroni, the same Moroni who had given the gold plates to Joseph Smith 67 years earlier, visited Coyle in a dream. Moroni guided Coyle to the top of a nearby mountain, where the ground opened to admit them deep into the earth. There Moroni led Coyle through the 9 enormous caverns overflowing with gold. It had been gathered by the Nephites of the Book of Mormon, but all that wealth had made them prideful and covetous, so God had taken it away from them some 2,000 years ago and hidden it deep beneath this mountain, along with ancient records documenting the entire history of the Mormons' forebears. Moroni informed Coyle that the gold would remain hidden inside the mountain until just before the second coming of Christ, by which time the world's mightiest civilizations would have crumbled and horrible strife would afflict all of humankind. At that desperate moment, Coyle would unearth the Nephite's gold and use it to provide for the faithful, enabling them to survive the privations of the last days. Moroni showed Coyle exactly where he should start digging and assured him the gold would eventually be unearthed there, but not until the second coming was imminent. Coyle filed a mining claim on the hillside east of Salem and started digging on September 17, 1894. At the time, much of the American West was undergoing a boom in mining, so it was relatively easy for Coyle to find financial backers. Almost all of them devout Mormons who saw the dream mine as a sound spiritual investment, as well as a surefire way to get rich. Some 700,000 shares of stock were eventually sold. By the mid-1940s, a shaft had been excavated 3,400 feet into the mountain. The fact that no gold had yet been found didn't particularly worry Coyle or his investors. Moroni had assured him that the riches would be uncovered when the last days were at hand, and not a moment before. The LDS leadership, though, took a dim view of Coyle's mine. In the modern church, as in Joseph Smith's day, major revelations were supposed to be channeled through the LDS president, prophet, seer, and revelator, and nobody else. Church authorities repeatedly proclaimed that Coyle was a false prophet and warned the faithful not to invest in the dream mine, but many saints continued to believe in Coyle's vision. Finally, in 1948, the LDS leadership excommunicated Coyle. Heartbroken and humiliated, he died a year later. Thousands of Coyle's followers, however, remained convinced that Coyle's prophecy would eventually come to pass, and remain convinced today. The prophet Onias is one of these believers. Onias first heard about the dream mine shortly after he converted to Mormonism. He bought 300 shares of stock in the mine at $3 a share, and later persuaded his mother to buy 300 shares as well. In the late 1970s, he began receiving revelations about the mine. The Lord commanded him to buy land in Salem at the base of the mine and build a city of refuge there, where the righteous could hunker down in safety during the last days when all hell broke loose around them. Onias moved to Utah County and made a $1,500 down payment on 5 acres below the mine entrance. Along the way, he crossed paths with Bernard Brady and Kenyon Blackmore, local businessmen and ardent supporters of the Dream Mine, who owned expensive homes in an upscale community immediately adjacent to the mine. Brady is a fleshy, pink-faced man in his mid-50s who is easy to like. A natural salesman, he maintains a relentlessly upbeat demeanor that only occasionally shows cracks around the edges. Born into a good Mormon family in Malad City, Idaho, just north of the Utah border, at the age of 19, immediately prior to embarking on a 2-year LDS mission to Switzerland, he had an experience that changed his life. Before leaving Malad, he developed a severe allergic reaction to a routine inoculation. "I felt really strange and kind of weak right after they gave me the shots," he recalls. "I had to sit down. They gave me some orange juice and I started feeling better, so I left the doctor's office and went back to work. But soon after Brady returned to his job, filling bags of flour at his family's grain mill, he started feeling woozy, prompting his mother to drive him home. It was a hot August day," he says, "but I felt this unbelievable chill, like I was going to freeze to death. So she put me on her bed with all these blankets and went in to call the doctor. All of a sudden, I stopped breathing. Just quit. Then I noticed that the ceiling was coming closer and closer and closer. It took me a moment to realize that the ceiling wasn't moving. I was. I was floating. I turned and looked down and saw my body there on the bed below me. But the thing I remember most was this overwhelmingly powerful feeling of peace and well-being and love. That all was well in the world. I'd never felt anything like it. It was absolutely amazing. I was just about to hit the ceiling and bust right through it when I started thinking to myself, something isn't right here. I should be breathing. So I commanded myself to breathe, and soon as I did that, I immediately found myself back down on the bed inside my body, and my lungs started filling with air. But after I'd exhaled, my breathing didn't automatically continue. It stopped again. So I thought, well, I better do that again. So I did that about 3 times, willing myself to breathe each time. And then my body finally took over and I started breathing again involuntarily. But when I started breathing, I felt awful again, really sick, where just a few seconds earlier I'd been feeling so good floating around in the room. Upon regaining consciousness, Brady was rushed to the hospital by his mother. After spending a night there, he recovered fully, but his near-death experience made a profound impression that has remained with him very vividly ever since. As he floated high above his body in the throes of anaphylactic shock, God ceased to be an abstract concept. He had felt the presence of the Lord firsthand, and he yearned to recapture that overpowering sense of the divine in his Mormon faith. For several years before he met the prophet Onias, Brady had been growing increasingly disaffected with the LDS Church. He was discouraged by the lack of religious passion among most of the Mormons he knew. Too many members of the church seemed to him to be merely going through the motions, treating it more as a social organization than as a means for spiritual enlightenment. Then in the late 1970s, Brady met Kenyon Blackmore and entered into a business partnership with him, selling investments in tax shelters and other financial instruments that promised incredibly high returns to speculators. "Ken was really intriguing to me," says Brady. "He knew more about Mormonism than anybody I've ever met, yet he said he wasn't a Mormon. After I'd worked with him for 6 months or so, I sat him down and asked him to level with me. How can you know all this stuff and not be a member of the LDS Church?" So he took a deep breath and told me all about fundamentalism. Blackmore turned out to be a Canadian-born polygamist. Although he wasn't directly affiliated with the UEP or any other fundamentalist group, one of his first cousins was Winston Blackmore, who had recently maneuvered to become the leader of the polygamists in bountiful British Columbia, with whom Onias had once been friendly. Two of Onias's daughters were in fact married to Winston Blackmore's brothers, Kenyon Blackmore's cousins. "Ken was my first exposure to Mormon fundamentalism," Brady continues. "The whole concept sort of blew me away. All these things that Joseph Smith had revealed but had then been abandoned by the modern church. I went home and shared what Ken had told me with my wife. She and I both did a lot of questioning about whether it was true or not. We went through an intense period of investigating and fasting and praying. At the end, both of us were impressed that the fundamentalist message was basically true. And if it was true, we couldn't ignore it. That was the frame of mind I was in when I first met the prophet Onias, Bob Crossfield. Because Brady was a stockholder in the Dream Mine, he was well acquainted with the prophecies of John Coyle, one of which referred to a lightly complected man with white hair who would come from the north with whom the stockholders would rally and bring remarkable changes in and around the mine. This seemed to predict the arrival of Onias in Salem, impressing Brady. Coincidentally, at the time he met Onias, Onias was in the process of putting together an organization called the School of the Prophets, and he invited Brady to become one of the school's 6 original counselors. Modeled on an institution of the same name established by Joseph Smith in 1832, Onias intended his School of the Prophets to be a mechanism for instilling crucial Mormon principles that had been forsaken by the modern LDS Church. Plural marriage. The tenet that God and Adam, the first man, were one and the same, and the divinely ordained supremacy of the white race. All of which was customary fundamentalist fare. But there was one aspect of Onias's School of the Prophets that set him apart from the leaders of other polygamist sects. He instructed his followers how to receive divine revelations. Indeed, teaching this sacred art, which had been widely practiced by Mormons in Joseph's day, yet all but abandoned by the modern church, was the school's main thrust. Onias intended to restore the gift of revelation by teaching 20th century saints how to hear the still, small voice of God, which, as Joseph explained in section 85 of the Doctrine and Covenants, whispereth through and pierceth all things, and oftentimes it maketh my bones to quake. Brady, energized by Onias's ideas, set out to recruit worthy candidates for the school. One of them turned out to be a fellow named Watson Lafferty, Jr. He was a real quality individual, Brady asserts, and Watson said he had 5 brothers who were just like him. So I met them, and the whole Lafferty family was outstanding. They all had real strong convictions, but especially Watson's older brother, Dan. He would go out of his way to help others much more than most people would. And Dan was unique in the strength of his desire to do what was meaningful, to do what was right. A white lie here and there? To most people, that wouldn't be a big thing. But to Dan, it would be unthinkable. Brady pauses, and a look of overwhelming regret darkens his face. For a moment, he looks like he's going to burst into tears. He recovers his composure with visible effort, then, in a faltering voice, continues, "So I introduced Dan Lafferty to Bob Crossfield. Looking back on it now, it's unfortunate that I was the catalyst who brought Bob and the Laffertys together. But it happened." Chapter 8. The Peacemaker. In an age in which economists take for granted that people equate well-being with consumption, increasing numbers of people seem willing to trade certain freedoms and material comforts for a sense of immutable order and the rapture of faith. Eugene Linden, The Future in Plain Sight. Dan Lafferty grew up with his 5 brothers and 2 sisters on a 4-acre farm just west of Salem, Utah. Their father, Watson Lafferty Sr., had served as a barber on an aircraft carrier in World War II. Following the war, he enrolled in chiropractic college on the GI Bill. Upon completion of his training, he opened a combination chiropractic practice, barbershop, beauty salon in a spare room in his home, and settled down to raise his family to be exemplary Latter-day Saints. Watson Lafferty spent a lot of time thinking about God. He also spent a lot of time thinking about the government and the relationship the former should properly have with the latter. He was highly impressed with the ideas of Ezra Taft Benson, the prominent Mormon apostle, Red Baiter, and John Birch Society supporter, who in 1961 announced that there was an insidious infiltration of communist agents and sympathizers into almost every segment of American life. Benson, who served as Secretary of Agriculture under President Eisenhower, eventually became president and prophet of the entire LDS Church, holding that position from 1985 until his death in 1994. Even in arch-conservative, ultra-Mormon Utah County, the hard rightward lean of Watson's political views, as well as his extreme piety, caused the Lafferty patriarch to stand out. Dan characterizes his dad as strong-willed, a very individual individual, and strict about a lot of things. In fact, Watson Lafferty was a formidable disciplinarian who did not hesitate to beat the living tar out of his children or his wife Claudine to enforce his rules. Commonly, the children were present to witness the punishment when Watson hit Claudine, a reserved, submissive wife whom Dan describes as a good woman and an excellent mother. The children were also present when Watson clubbed the family dog to death with a baseball bat. Among Watson Lafferty's more strongly held beliefs was a deep distrust of conventional medicine. When Dan's oldest sister, Colleen, came down with acute appendicitis as a young girl, their father was adamant that she be treated at home with prayer and homeopathic remedies. Only after her appendix burst and death was imminent did he grudgingly take Colleen to the hospital. Watson ultimately died himself in 1983 after refusing medical treatment for advanced diabetes. Despite the fact that Watson was a violent bully, Dan loved his father intensely and admired him. To this day, Dan considers him a superb role model. "I was blessed to be raised in a very special and happy family," Dan insists. "We never wanted for anything. My parents truly loved and cared for each other." Dan recalls that his dad often took his mom out dancing, and it wasn't unusual to hear my father ask my mother if he had told her lately that he loved her. Once when Dan was attending the Provo Temple with his family, with everyone dressed in white temple garments and the women and men sitting on opposite sides of the hall, he remembers his father leaning over to ask him, sotto voce, if I had ever seen anyone as beautiful as my mother, as she sat with the other women across the room. In the celestial glow of the temple's sacred chambers, Dan remembers vividly his mother looked angelic and radiant. According to Dan, his parents placed their family at the very center of their life along with the LDS Church. The Laffertys belonged to a congregation in the nearby community of Spring Lake, says Dan, and worshipped at the perfect picture postcard church by a lake with just a few houses around. It was in that lake where I learned to swim and fish, and in the winter we had ice skating parties with family and friends. Young Dan was a model Latter-day Saint, virtuous and compliant, zooming down the highway to heaven, as he puts it. I was 110%er. I sang in the choir. I always paid my tithing. In fact, I always paid a little extra just to make sure I made it into the highest kingdom of glory. Although Dan's father adhered rigidly to Mormon doctrine, he could not be called a fundamentalist. "I don't think the word polygamy was ever mentioned while I was growing up," says Dan. "It never even crossed my mind. The first time I ever had a conversation with anyone about polygamy, it was about a group of missionaries in France who were excommunicated after they studied Section 132 together and decided polygamy was a principle that should be practiced. I can still remember thinking to myself, how could anyone sacrifice their membership in the church over that old, discontinued principle?" After high school, Dan went on a 2-year mission to Scotland, where he met Matilda Loomis, a divorced mother of 2 young girls who made a powerful impression on him. 6 years after returning from his mission, Dan bumped into Matilda by chance at a missionary reunion. "I was getting kind of old by then," Dan says, "and my father and older brother Ron are beginning on me to get married. I'd met a lot of lovely girls previously, but whenever I prayed about whether I should marry them, I realized none of them was the right one. So then I ran into Matilda at this reunion, and I thought, well, I should probably pray about marrying her, too, before she goes back to Scotland, just in case that's what God has in mind for me. And this time I was quite surprised to get a positive answer to my prayers. So I told Matilda that we should get married. I thought it was going to be really awkward trying to explain that God intended her to be my wife, and I was worried how she would react. So I was kind of thrown off when she answered, 'Yeah, I know.' I said, 'What do you mean, I know?' She explained that God had told her to come to America just for that reason, to get married. She said that she was expecting me to ask her. Within 3 months, Dan and Matilda were sealed as husband and wife in the Provo Temple and moved to California with Matilda's kids in tow so that Dan could enroll in the Los Angeles College of Chiropractic. One Sunday near the end of their 5 years in California, Dan and Matilda happened to hear a member of their local LDS ward give a talk about plural marriage. During the talk, this guy said, "Okay, let's see a show of hands from everybody who comes from a polygamous background," Dan recalls. And there were only like 4 people who didn't raise their hands in the whole congregation. That really got my attention. I decided to learn everything I could about polygamy. When Dan completed his chiropractic training, he moved his family back to Utah County, and there he embarked on an energetic investigation of the polygamous history of the Latter-day Saints. Nosing around in the special collections of the Brigham Young University Library one afternoon, he came across a 51-page typescript of a 19th-century tract in praise of plural marriage. An extract from a manuscript entitled The Peacemaker, or The Doctrines of the Millennium, being a treatise on religion and jurisprudence, or a new system of religion and politics. It had been written by a mysterious figure named Udney Hay Jacob. The booklet's title page indicated that it had been published in 1842 in Nauvoo, Illinois, and that the printer was none other than Joseph Smith himself. The Peacemaker offered an elaborate biblical rationale for polygamy, which it proposed as a cure for the myriad ills that plagued monogamous relationships, and by extension, all of humankind. Part of that cure was making sure that women remained properly subservient, as God intended. According to the tract, "The government of the wife is therefore placed in the husband by the law of God, for he is the head. I suffer not a woman, saith the Lord, to teach, or to usurp authority over a man, but to be in subjection." A right understanding of this matter and a correct law properly executed would restore this nation to peace and order, and man to his true dignity, authority, and government of the earthly creation. It would soon rectify the domestic circle and establish a proper head over the families of the earth, together with the knowledge and restitution of the whole penal law of God, and be the means of driving Satan, yea, of driving Satan from the human mind. Gentlemen, the ladies laugh at your pretended authority. They, many of them, hiss at the idea of your being the lords of the creation. Nothing is further from the minds of our wives in general than the idea of submitting to their husbands in all things, and of reverencing their husbands. They will boldly ridicule the idea of calling them sincerely in their hearts lords and masters. But God has positively required this of them. Here the wife is pronounced the husband's property, as much so as his manservant, his maidservant, his ox, or his horse. It is evident that by abandoning the sacred principle of plural marriage, an endless catalogue of crime has been created that otherwise could never have existed, and that does exist at this moment in these states. Husbands forsake their wives and often brutally abuse them. Fathers forsake their children. Young maidens are seduced and abandoned by the deceiver. Wives are poisoned and put to death by their husbands. Husbands are murdered by their wives. Newborn babes are cruelly murdered to hide the false shame created by the false and wicked and tyrannical law against polygamy. While on the other hand, polygamy regulated by the law of God as illustrated in this book could not possibly produce one crime. Neither could it injure any human being. The stupidity of modern Christian nations upon this subject is horribly astonishing. The question is not now to be debated whether these things are so. Neither is it a question of much importance who wrote this book. But the question, the momentous question, is, will you now restore the law of God on this important subject and keep it? Remember that the law of God is given by inspiration of the Holy Ghost. Speak not a word against it at your peril. Because Joseph Smith was listed on the title page as the printer of The Peacemaker, because the treatise precisely reflected many of his teachings, and because it concluded with the cryptic declaration that it was not a question of much importance who wrote this book, scholars and others have long speculated that Joseph was the author. Determining who wrote The Peacemaker was important to Dan Lafferty. "I really wanted to know if this was Joseph Smith's writing," he says. "So I studied and prayed, and after a period of time the Lord gave me enough knowledge to become quite satisfied that Joseph Smith wrote it. I don't know for sure that it's Joseph Smith, but I'll be surprised if it wasn't." The fact that The Peacemaker was apparently the work of the prophet made Dan especially receptive to the ideas expounded in its pages. With all the zeal one would expect from a 110%er, he wasted no time in applying the book's fundamentalist strictures to his household, which had by then grown to include Matilda, her two daughters from a previous marriage, and four children she and Dan had conceived together. Under the new rules, Matilda was no longer allowed to drive, handle money, or talk to anyone outside the family when Dan wasn't present, and she had to wear a dress at all times. The children were pulled out of school and forbidden to play with their friends. Dan decreed that the family was to receive no outside medical care. He began treating them himself by means of prayer, fasting, and herbal remedies. In July 1983, when their fifth child was born, a son, Dan delivered the baby at home and circumcised the boy himself. They began raising much of their own food, scavenging the rest from dumpsters behind grocery stores, where stale, unsold bread and overripe produce were regularly discarded. Dan turned off the gas and electricity. No publications of any kind were allowed in the home except LDS books and magazines. Dan even got rid of all their watches and clocks, believing they should keep time by the Spirit. When Matilda disobeyed Dan, he spanked her. Spank was the verb Dan used. According to Matilda, the blows he delivered felt more like thumps. And when he thumped her, he often did it in front of Dan's mother, his brothers, and all their children. Afterward, he warned Matilda that if she continued to disobey, she would be forced out of the marriage without her children, who, according to the principles elucidated in The Peacemaker, were the father's property. Dan also announced that he intended to engage in spiritual wifery at the earliest opportunity, and the first woman he proposed taking as a plural wife was Matilda's oldest daughter, his own stepdaughter. "I had come to a place there was no choices," Matilda later testified in court. "I could either go and leave my kids or stay and accept it." She elected to stay. Matilda said that the first years of their marriage had been extremely happy and hopeful, and then it just disintegrated. I would dream of him dying so I could get out. By then, she said, her life had become a hellish situation. Part 2. The earnest cadres of bureaucrats who today direct the Mormon Church's growth across the world are the spiritual descendants of those deeply disciplined Mormon pioneers. The Mormon Church, then and now, is founded upon complete obedience to hierarchical church authority and to the surety of revelation from above. The doctrine of obedience sounds inimical to American individualism and alien to Protestantism generally, and it is. Yet the American frontier where Mormonism grew up has always been riven by contradictory attitudes toward individualism. It could be deadly in a place where cooperation and indeed absolute obedience of the kind Mormons then and now understand might offer the only means to survive. Survival was often collective or not at all, a lesson not lost on Mormons of later generations. Though the contemporary image of Mormons may be one of conservative rectitude, hopelessly middle class and lower middle brow, tinged with both the church's 19th century polygamous past and its refusal until the 1970s to give up official racism, the institutional preoccupation of the church from its moment of inception has been with sheer survival. Kenneth Anderson, The Magic of the Great Salt Lake, Times Literary Supplement, March 24, 1995. It is almost impossible to write fiction about the Mormons, for the reasons that Mormon institutions and Mormon society are so peculiar that they call for constant explanation. Wallace Stegner, Mormon Country. Chapter 9. Hawn's Mill. Bearing persecution became the distinctive badge of membership in the church. It was the test of faith and of one's chosenness. By the end of their stay in Missouri, Mormons had accumulated a long list of trials to commemorate. Opposition gives value to struggle and inculcates self-confidence. It is difficult to imagine a successful Mormon church without suffering, without the encouragement of it, without the memory of it. Persecution, arguably, was the only possible force that would have allowed the infant church to prosper. R. Lawrence Moore, Religious Outsiders and the Making of Americans. When Mormonism made its debut, Joseph Smith's embryonic religion was not welcomed with open arms by everyone. The very first review of the Book of Mormon, published in the Rochester Daily Advertiser on April 2, 1830, 4 days before Joseph's church was even legally incorporated, typified reaction to the new faith among many in western New York. The review began, "The Book of Mormon has been placed in our hands. A viler imposition was never practiced. It is an evidence of fraud, blasphemy, and credulity, shocking both to Christians and moralists." Joseph's widespread reputation as a charlatan, along with a rash of malicious rumors about his gold Bible, had fueled animosity throughout the Palmyra region. In December 1830, Joseph received a revelation in which God, noting the hostility in the New York air, commanded him to move his flock to Ohio. So the Latter-day Saints packed up and resettled just east of present-day Cleveland in a town called Kirtland. In Ohio, the Mormons found their neighbors to be relatively hospitable, but in the summer of 1831, the Lord revealed to Joseph that Kirtland was merely a way station, and that the Missouri frontier was, in fact, the land which I have appointed and consecrated for the gathering of the saints. God explained that northwestern Missouri was among the earth's holiest places. The Garden of Eden had not been located in the Middle East, as many believed, but rather in Jackson County, Missouri, near what by the 19th century had become the city of Independence. And it was here, too, that Christ would make his triumphant return before the century was out. Heeding the Lord's words, Joseph instructed his followers to assemble in Jackson County and start building a new Jerusalem there. Saints began pouring into northwestern Missouri and continued arriving in ever greater numbers through 1838. The people who already lived in Jackson County were not happy about the monumental influx. The Mormon immigrants, for the most part, hailed from the northeastern states and favored the abolition of slavery. Missourians tended to have southern roots. Many of them actually owned slaves and were deeply suspicious of the Mormons' abolitionist leanings. But what alienated the residents of Jackson County most was the impenetrable clannishness of the Mormons and their arrogant sense of entitlement. The saints insisted they were God's chosen people and had been granted a divine right to claim northwestern Missouri as their Zion. Everything the Mormons did seemed to heighten the Missourians' apprehension. The saints used church funds to purchase large tracts of land in Jackson County. They engaged in commerce exclusively with other saints whenever possible, undermining local businesses. They voted in a uniform block in strict accordance with Joseph's directives, and as their numbers increased, they threatened to dominate regional politics. Reflecting a common fear among Missourians, a letter published in 1833 in a Fayette newspaper warned, "The day is not far distant when the sheriff, the justices, and the county judges will be Mormons." Mormons were eager to embrace any Gentiles who cared to convert, but the saints had little interest in associating with Missourians who remained too ignorant or obstinate to grasp God's plan for mankind. Joseph preached something he called free agency. Everyone was free to choose whether to be on the side of the Lord or the side of wickedness. It was an entirely personal decision. But woe to those who decided wrong. If you knowingly chose to shun the God of Joseph and the saints, you were utterly undeserving of sympathy or mercy. This polarizing mindset, "If you're not with us, you're against us," was underscored by a revelation Joseph received in 1831, in which God commanded the saints to "assemble yourselves together to rejoice upon the land of Missouri, which is the land of your inheritance, which is now the land of your enemies." When Missourians became aware of this commandment, they regarded it as an open declaration of war, an impression that seemed to be confirmed by an article published in a Mormon newspaper promising that the saints would literally tread upon the ashes of the wicked after they are destroyed from off the face of the earth. In the 1830s, northwestern Missouri was still untamed country, inhabited by rough, strong-willed characters. Jackson County residents initially responded to the perceived Mormon threat by holding town meetings, passing anti-Mormon resolutions, and demanding that civil authorities take some kind of action. When such gestures failed to stem the tide of saints, however, the citizens of Independence took matters into their own hands. In July 1833, an armed mob of 500 Missourians tarred and feathered two Latter-day Saints and destroyed a printing office because an LDS newspaper had published an article deemed overly sympathetic to the anti-slavery viewpoint. 3 days later, the same mob rounded up 9 Mormon leaders and, under the threat of death, forced them to sign an oath promising to leave Jackson County within a year. That autumn, thugs razed 10 homes, killed one saint, and stoned numerous others. Then one cold November night, vigilantes systematically terrorized every Mormon settlement in the region. After savagely beating the men, they drove 1,200 saints from their homes, forcing them to run for their lives into the frigid darkness. Most of them fled north across the Missouri River, never to return to Jackson County. Joseph deplored violence, and for the better part of 5 years he forbade the Mormons to retaliate, even though the attacks against them continued. But by the summer and fall of 1838, the tension between Gentiles and the 10,000 saints who were by then in Missouri reached critical mass. In 1836, the Missouri legislature, hoping to relocate the saints in an out-of-the-way place that would forestall bloodshed, had designated sparsely populated Caldwell County as a zone of Mormon settlement, prompting most of the saints in Missouri to move there from adjacent, less welcoming counties. By 1838, the Mormons had purchased some 250,000 acres in Caldwell County from the federal government and built a thriving town they christened Far West. At first, the exodus to Caldwell County seemed to diffuse the tension between Mormons and Gentiles. But in the summer of 1838, trouble erupted in neighboring Davis County, where Mormons had spilled over the county line and begun establishing large new settlements. August 6th was Election Day in Missouri. That morning after the polls opened in Gallatin, the Davies County seat, a Whig candidate for the state legislature, William Penniston, climbed on top of a barrel and bellowed to the rabble that Mormons were horse thieves, liars, counterfeiters, and dupes. Hoping to prevent the 30 or so Mormons present from casting their ballots, another Missourian then loudly opined that Mormons should no more have the right to vote than the niggers. The incendiary rhetoric provoked a drunk Missourian to beat up a diminutive Mormon shoemaker named Samuel Brown. When other Mormons came to Brown's aid, a vicious brawl broke out. Wielding clubs, rocks, whips, and knives, the badly outnumbered saints managed to overcome the Missourians and drive them off, leaving dozens of their foes severely wounded. But it was a Pyrrhic victory. The enraged citizens of Gallatin vowed to pay the Mormons back in kind. Over the next 2 months, Missourians launched a campaign of harassment and violence against the Mormon residents of Davies County, forcing most of them from their homes. Finally, on October 14th in Far West, Joseph assembled several hundred of his followers in the town square and urged them to fight back. Seething, the prophet declared, "We are an injured people. From county to county, we have been driven by unscrupulous mobs eager to seize the land we have cleared and improved with such love and toil. We have appealed to magistrates, judges, the governor, and even the president of the United States, but there has been no redress for us. If the people will let us alone, we will preach the gospel in peace. But if they come on us to molest us, we will establish our religion by the sword. We will trample down our enemies and make it one gore of blood from the Rocky Mountains to the Atlantic Ocean. I will be to this generation a second Muhammad, whose motto in treating for peace was the Al-Quran, Quran, or the sword. So shall it eventually be with us. Joseph Smith, or the sword." Joseph was not the only person to draw parallels between the founding prophets of Mormonism and Islam. Most such comparisons were made by Gentile critics intending to denigrate the saints and their faith, but certain undeniable similarities were also noted by those sympathetic to Joseph's church. Among these admirers was Sir Joseph F. Burton, the famous 19th-century libertine and adventurer who had extensive first-hand knowledge of Islamic cultures. Upon visiting Salt Lake City soon after the Mormons arrived there, Burton observed that Mormonism, like El-Islam, claimed to be a restoration by revelation of the pure and primeval religion of the world. In 1904, the esteemed German scholar Eduard Meyer spent a year in Utah studying the saints, which moved him to predict, "As Arabia was to be the inheritance of the Muslims, so was America to become the inheritance of the Mormons." And in 1932, after acknowledging in a book called Revelation in Mormonism that similarities between Islam and Mormonism have been misunderstood and exaggerated, George Arbaugh nevertheless went on to assert, "Mormonism is one of the most boldly innovating developments in the history of religions. Its aggressive theocratic claims, political aspirations, and use of force make it akin to Islam." It was an impassioned speech, and the Mormons responded. Venting years of pent-up anger, they began raiding Gentile towns and plundering food, livestock, and valuables, burning approximately 50 non-Mormon homes in the process. Outraged, Missourians retaliated with counterattacks, destroying several Mormon cabins. 11 days after Joseph's forceful call to arms, a skirmish resulted in the death of 3 saints and 1 Gentile. Making matters even worse, the carnage from this fight was wildly exaggerated in an inflammatory letter to Missouri Governor Lilburn Boggs, wherein it was falsely reported that the saints had slaughtered 50 Missourians. Upon reading this, Boggs, who had won the 1836 gubernatorial election on an anti-Mormon platform, issued a now infamous order to the top-ranked general of the Missouri militia. "The Mormons must be treated as enemies and must be exterminated or driven from the state if necessary for the public peace. Their outrages are beyond all description." Days later, 3 companies of the Missouri militia, commanded by Colonel Thomas Jennings, launched a surprise attack on a Mormon settlement known as Hahn's Mill. Late in the afternoon of October 30th, 1838, as the sun hung low and red in a beautiful Indian summer sky, some 25 Mormon families working in the fields were surprised to see 240 troops appear suddenly from the surrounding woods, aim their muskets, and fire in unison at the saints. The commander of the Mormons, realizing that his lightly armed community had no chance against such an overwhelming force, immediately waved his hat and yelled out his desire to surrender. The Missourians ignored his pleas for mercy and kept shooting, inciting panic among the saints. Many of the Mormons scattered into nearby thickets, but 3 boys and 15 men sought refuge inside the settlement's blacksmith shop. There were wide, unchinked gaps between the logs that formed the walls, and shooting the Mormons through these gaps was no more difficult for the Missourians than plinking hogs in a pen. As more and more saints were killed, the Missourians